Welcome, everybody, to Health, Wealth, and Divine. My name is Jawanza. Thank you so much for tuning in. It's a beautiful day outside, and I certainly hope that everybody is enjoying it, and I'm sure that you're going to enjoy this show. It's an honor and a privilege to have as a regular monthly, well, actually a biweekly now, contributor to Health, Wealth, and Divine, someone who's been just an expert in their particular chosen field of endeavor, that being entrepreneurship, and has written a book, a powerful book that just keeps growing and growing and growing. So for all of you entrepreneurs out there, I want to just, if you've never heard this show before, you're going to love it, I guarantee you. And for those of you who have been following the show, I know that you've been waiting for Professor Joseph T. Geiger to come back. He's my special guest again today. He's written an awesome book, and it's actually titled Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top. It's up to 105 business principles. It started off as 101 business principles, but it just keeps growing and growing and growing. And so I have the privilege of going through the book with you all, chapter by chapter, principle by principle. So, again, for all of you entrepreneurs out there, you know that the endeavor that you've chosen, if you decided to start your own business from scratch, it's not like, you know, if you haven't inherited a business or something, but you actually had to go through the process of starting a business from scratch, you know how intense and how detailed that can be. And so this book was written so that process could be made so much easier for you. There are a lot of businesses that fail within the first year. Over half of all businesses that start up fail within the first year. And so if you follow the principles in this book, I guarantee you, you're going to cut that number down significantly. So let me tell you a little bit about my guest today. Professor Joseph T. Geiger, again, is my special guest, currently retired. Professor Geiger grew up on a Kansas farm and graduated from the School of Business at the University of Denver. And over his lifetime, he has started over 10 businesses, two of which predated his college graduation. And after his second retirement, he taught entrepreneurship and small business management at J. Sargent Reynolds Community College, located in Richmond, Virginia, where he currently resides. And again, he's my special guest today. Professor, welcome back to Health, Wealth, and Divine. As always, it's an honor, a privilege to have you back, and can't wait for another exciting show.
Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. You know, Professor, again, every time I, you know, think about this book and think about you and having, you know, the honor of, you know, interviewing you, and you've been doing this for over 50 years. I don't know if I've ever asked you this question, but after you started, I mean, you started two businesses prior to even graduating from college. So upon graduation, did you ever hold down a regular 9-to-5? I mean, did you ever work for somebody else, or was it just entrepreneurship from that point on?
Well, it was pretty much from that point on. The only time I worked for somebody is when I had retired from entrepreneurship and sold my last company, and I got a job starting with, what was it? I think Home Depot was the first,
mm-hmm.
And I worked for them for a little while in the tool department. I worked for Office Depot for a little while, and then I got a job as a rent-a-cop at J. Sargent Reynolds, and it was through that I happened to meet, or really I kind of engineered the meeting with the head of the business department, and told him a little about myself, and he invited me to be a guest speaker a couple of times. And after the second guest speaker thing, which they weren't very long, they were about 15, 20 minutes, something like that. And after that, he said he would like for me to teach, and that I could teach the entrepreneurship and small business management, because, you know, I had actually done it over and over and over again. So they were kind of looking for that rather than somebody who had never run a business. As a matter of fact, the vast majority of people who teach entrepreneurship have never even worked for a business. And I know that because I have applied for jobs at several of the major colleges, but I do not have a master's degree. And without a master's degree, it's very, very difficult to get into a four-year. They actually want you to have a PhD. And I know from being there, when I applied at them, I would research everybody in the business department and to see if they had, at least the entrepreneurship people, if they had actually worked for somebody. And I found that nobody had. It was 100% at VCU at the time I researched it, at University of Richmond, and neither of them, and actually I also tried at University of Virginia. And all three of those, at the time that I tried, not a single professor who taught entrepreneurship had ever even worked for a free enterprise, much less started a business.
Wow.
So, it's kind of like me trying to teach somebody how to play the clarinet. I've never played any kind of a instrument of any sort. And so I'm going to try to read a book and teach somebody how to play the clarinet. I doubt it. At least I doubt if I could do a very good job of it. But that's when I first worked for a company other than when I was in college, and I worked as a busboy and a waiter at restaurants. But those were pretty much part-time jobs so I could get a good place to eat.
Well, you graduated.
Say again?
I was going to say, you graduated from the School of Business at the University of Denver. Do you think that you were prepared, that the courses that you took there prepared you for entrepreneurship? And the reason I ask that is because, of course, there would be certain, for lack of a better term, principles or courses of study that you would have had to, have taken that could have lent to your knowledge concerning, what to kind of do, for example, like we're going to get into today, we'll be talking about financial statements. And do you think that the School of Business prepared you for entrepreneurship?
No, at the time, I don't think the word was in the lexicon here in the United States. It probably was in France because it is a French word. But I never heard the word entrepreneur until, goodness, I was in my 40s. And I never heard the word. The University of Denver, which had a very, very fine business school, but it was like all business schools at the time, they tried to prepare you so you could go to work for IBM or, General Motors or some big company. And that was all the thrust. So, we took courses I took a course or two in accounting, but they didn't teach me sic'em about how to look at a financial statement from a small business and running it. I knew they taught us how to do debits and credits and how to do a financial statement and put it up and add it up and come up with a statement, but that's not what a small business person wants. Nowadays, you can get a computer program that does a great job of that. But what you as an entrepreneur want is, what does all this stuff really mean? And how can I do a better job of running my business with the help of understanding a financial statement? They taught nothing about that. That didn't even come up.
Well,
so at the time, there was nothing about being an entrepreneur. Didn't exist.
And even today, when you said it was like, for example, 40 years ago, or you were in your 40s, actually, when you first heard the term entrepreneur, and of course, since then, the word has become popular here in the United States now, whereas before, nobody had ever heard of it. Now, it's, everybody's heard the word. Everybody's heard the term.
Yeah.
But few people really know how to actually take principles, or at least the ones who have written books on the principles in entrepreneurship, only give you a few principles. But, you know, as you stated, you know, there's obviously more principles that you'll need to know than one or two or 10 or 20, because as you become an entrepreneur and as you go through the process, of course, there are going to be a lot of different things that pop up unexpectedly. So with this book having that as its foundation, or this book being written with that in mind, everybody, I want to make sure that you know how you can get this book. So during the course of the show, we're going to tell you how you can get this book. It's up to 100, started off as 101 principles. It's up to 105 now. And we're going through the book chapter by chapter, principle by principle. We're almost finished with the chapter on the business plan, which is chapter 3. And we're actually at the last principle in the business plan, which is everything costs more and takes longer. And then after we cover that, we're going to move into the next chapter, which is how entrepreneurs view financial statements. That is going to be a very, very critical piece to this whole financial, because you're going to be dealing with finances as you become an entrepreneur. And if you're already one, you know that you're going to be dealing with finances. And viewing financial statements is a very important piece. And so we're going to be covering that in detail. So, but before we move into that chapter, again, we're going to go back and look at the last principle in the business plan section, which is everything costs more and takes longer. Professor, could you talk about that?
Yeah, let me say one other thing about my book that differs from others, and the reason there's so many principles. In other books, there are general principles, but what business people want to know is how can I execute this principle? And so it needs to be fairly specific, and so how can I actually do it? And if you're taking a course in entrepreneurship and they give you a principle or a general thing, ask yourself, well, this all sounds fine, but how can I actually execute it? And if there isn't an answer, and a pretty obvious answer, maybe what they're teaching you is not very valuable. So with that little bit, everything takes longer, costs more, and takes longer. I put that in there because in planning, you have to figure how long it's going to take you to do something. And my experience is that regardless of how many times I do it, I virtually always get it wrong. And I always get it wrong on I think it can be done quicker, and I think it costs less than it actually does. Now, the reason that's critically important is one of the other principles that we either have come up with already or will shortly, and that is you're broke if you can't make payroll on Friday. So running out of money is a definition of being broke. And so if it takes longer and costs more, generally speaking, what that means is that it's going to take longer before you stop spending money on whatever this issue is, and before you start making money on whatever you hope to accomplish. That's the take longer part, and the cost more is pretty obvious. You're burning up your cash, and nobody went broke when they had to. They had lots of cash, but the definition of being broke is not being able to make your bills. And if it takes longer to finish something and it costs more, that's the invitation to being broke. And so it's a real rallying cry that you need to be very careful when you do your business plan and look at every single issue. Can I do what I set out to do in the time that I have allotted, and can I do it for the cost that I have allotted? And you need to be pretty satisfied. If it costs less, like I say, nobody went broke because they had too much money. So if you put in there that it's going to cost you more than it turns out to be, hooray. because chances are you're going to run other things that are going to go in the other direction. And my experience is that, generally speaking, it takes longer and it does cost more, and it's a real way to run out of business, run out of money. I tell a story in the book about one of the early businesses, the bigger businesses that I started, and I thought that I had way, way more money than I needed. And as it turns out, I made it, but boy, I made it by the skin of my teeth. And I thought this was to start a new sales company of selling small airplanes. And I thought certainly I'd be able to sell the first one in 6 months. Well, actually, it took 7 months. And then it also took another 3 months after that to get the airplane built and ready for where I could pick it up and deliver. Well, you don't get paid until you deliver it. You know, no, nobody wants to pay for a car until you actually get the car. Well, the same thing is true of airplanes. So I was sitting there merrily burning up money. Now, as it turns out, that by the time I was ready to pick up for this first airplane, I had sold three more, but I hadn't been paid for them because I didn't have them. Mm-hmm. And I got that first airplane and got it delivered and paid for, but boy, I'll tell you, as the story will tell you in the book, it was really, really close. And I had all kinds of problems. I thought that I wouldn't have any trouble getting a loan for a week to go pick up the airplane, particularly when I had 30 or 40% of the cost of the airplane. I had about 35%, I guess, of my own money. Well, I had a very big problem. Nobody wanted to lend me money.
Right.
And it was for a week, for God's sakes. And I had a 35% down payment, as it were, and I needed it for a week. No bank wanted anything to do with me. And I finally found the guy at a bank who did. And he had to be shifty in order to do it. What I mean by that is he knew that if he turned this into headquarters, they would turn him down. So mm-hmm. what he did is he had me sit around until 4:30 on Friday, and the bank closed at 4. So the bank closed at 4, and we were in Sacramento, and the headquarters was San Francisco. So they picked up all the documents that had to go to San Francisco, and the guy left it at 4:30. And as soon as the courier left, he called me up to his desk and got me to sign the documents and gave me the check. And he said, "Now, you better be back here by noon on Monday with a payoff. Otherwise, I'm going to lose my job." Mm-hmm. And he had a lot of faith. Jim Douglas was his name, a deep friend still today. And
wow.
He saved me because nobody else would do it. And then he did the same thing on the next three airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time that I had sold four airplanes and they had made loans on them and they all been paid on time, because the loans were for a month, but I paid them off in 3 or 4 days. I always paid them on Monday. He'd give me the check on Friday after the courier left, and I was at his bank by noon on Monday and paid it off. And then he was able to get me a little line of credit, a floor plan, so I could stock one airplane. And he saved my rear, but it always took longer and it cost more. And I almost went down. I mean, this was sad. I mean, I had about $150,000 worth of airplanes sold at the time, which today would be $500,000. And because I couldn't finance the first one, 70% or 65% of the first one, the whole thing would go under, and I had the deposits, I had it all done, and couldn't get there. So it really impressed me. I'll never forget that one. So just
can you talk for a moment about the need for people to persevere, even, because you said you had been turned down by, you know, several banks.
Yeah.
But you kept plugging away. Some people, give up after the first or second attempt. Could you talk about just the need? I mean, there are going to be times when you need to go knocking, you know, not literally necessarily, but knocking on doors.
Yeah.
And you can't turn away if after two doors get slammed in your face.
Well, I couldn't afford to because I was in California. I put everything I had into it. I had nobody I could turn to if that didn't work. And so just because all the other banks had turned me down, I just kept at it. And I was down to, about 7-8 days before I met Jim, and I printed up all the documents that I needed that I carried around, so when I met somebody, I could lay it right on their desk. And I met Jim on a Friday, and the next Friday is when he funded me. And I was up against it. I was, you know, I was, it was all over.
Well,
and I had put every dime I had into this thing. And like I say, I had, at the time, I had the airplane was $50,000, which today would be $150,000. So it was dire. Absolutely dire. So you can't afford to quit.
With all of the experience that you have now, I mean, again, over 50 years experiences as an entrepreneur, looking back at that particular experience, what would you say the reason was that the other banks were turning you down and that Jim decided to take a chance on you? I mean, because the documentation had to be there for Jim to even, you know, to take a chance himself.
Yeah.
I mean, he had to have something to convince him. I'm just wondering, what was it that convinced him that didn't convince the other banks?
Jim was buggy over small airplanes. He loved to fly. That's the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And had he not done that, none of the others did. And general aviation, little airplanes, single engine airplanes are, most bankers think anybody who has one of those is a little bonkers anyway, because of if you're going to fly someplace, you get into a Boeing, for God's sakes, not in some little puddle jumper. And but he loved to fly. And that's the reason. Otherwise, I think he would have turned me down like everybody else did. But that was a different day. Today, I couldn't do that. It wouldn't happen today. And the reason it wouldn't happen today is Jim and his manager had, a $50,000 or $100,000 line of credit that they could make a loan for that amount on their own recognizance.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim could do about $50,000 on his own. That doesn't happen today unless you go to a little small bank. And what I tell people who are starting in business when you first get going, you don't want to go to Bank of America. What you want to do is find the bank that has three or four little branches. And the reason is very simple, is because if you do that, you can actually talk to the guy who makes the loan. But if you go to Bank of America or Union Bank or any of the big banks, and even some of the regional banks, you cannot talk to the guy who actually makes the loan.
Mm-hmm.
He's not available to you.
So, okay, no problem.
And
yes, go ahead.
So it's pretty important. And like I say, today, at that time, I could go to Bank of America or Union or Crocker Bank, which is what this was out there. It was a California bank all over California, and so they had lots of branches. Today, there's no way. There would be no Jim Douglas there. The person there that you talk to cannot, on their own, okay a loan for 10 cents. So when you go to a bank and get a loan for a house or a car or a refrigerator, the person you talk to cannot approve that loan. Somebody else does who you cannot meet.
You know, Professor, there's a statement that people have been using for years now, and I'm sure that in some instances it applies, but not all. And that statement is, it takes money to make money, you know. And I just bring this up because there's the principle is everything costs more and takes longer, so we just deal with the cost more part. Has that been your experience? And I know that it would depend on the particular situation, whatever the endeavor is. But has that been your experience? I mean, because people have thrown that around for years. It takes money to make money. It takes money to make money, and so. With that being the case, there have been people who may have considered going into or starting their own business, becoming an entrepreneur, but just didn't have money. And as a result of that, might not have known the process of, you know, going to a bank, getting the business plan together, going and sitting in front of a loan officer and that whole thing. Your thought on the statement, it takes money to make money?
Well, perhaps, you know. It certainly is a hell of a lot easier if you did a good job of picking very rich parents. You know, that helps a lot. If when you turn 21, you got a check for $100 million or some big amount. But frankly, the first business I had, I didn't have any money. I had to have a little. And so I did it without money, and it was I was at a boarding school. I'm dyslexic, and my parents sent me to a school that specialized in young kids who have a reading problem. And I was a freshman or a sophomore, and I noticed there, this was in the East in Massachusetts, and it was a boarding school out in the middle of nowhere. And all of many of the students wanted the New York Times on Sunday to read the sports and the funny papers and all that. And that it wasn't available. So I called up the person in a town about 15 miles away or so who had the franchise to wholesale New York Times newspapers. And I said, I have some people who want to buy the newspaper. We just want Sundays. And can you front me for 10 or 20 of them? And they said, not a chance. No way. We don't know you. You don't know us. When you're able to pay for some, okay. And when we get to know you, well, then we'll do better. So what I did is I went around to the young people who, my classmates, who wanted the newspaper and said, hey, guess what? I'll deliver you the newspaper on for the rest of this semester, but I need to get paid in advance. And so I did. I got 20 of them who came up with the money in advance, and that allowed me to buy 25 newspapers for every Sunday. And so I had, and I had a profit on it, needless to say. So by that was in the fall semester, in the spring semester, that gave me a little cash to start off with. Plus, so at the second semester, they said, well, you'll only have to pay for half. So if it was $100 for the newspapers, you'll have to pay 50. So then I had about 35 or 40 kids who wanted it. And so I had the money to do that just barely. But I went around to them, and I got paid again in advance. So in that case, what got me started, I didn't have any money. So I did it all promoting it. And the second business I had took very little. The third one took a little cash to start with, but I had leftovers from the first and second.
Mm-hmm.
So there is truth to what they say, but it isn't 100% true. And some of the very big businesses that we are all, you know, Apple, those guys started it in a garage, and they had enough to put together, cobble together a few little computers, and then they got a little start, and then they got one when it looked like it would go, they got a very big start. Then they got money to make money. But to start with, they didn't have any. You know, they sold their car, they sold everything they had, they worked out of their parents' garage, and it turned into Apple.
Hmm.
So I think that's more, a lot of that's a cop-out.
Hmm.
There is no question. I mean, I have started businesses where I had millions, and I have started businesses where I had nothing. And admittedly, it's a whole lot easier if you have millions. But it can be done if you don't.
Everybody, my special guest is Professor Joseph T. Geiger. We're going through his book, Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top 105 Business Principles. We're going through the book principle by principle, chapter by chapter. We just ended up with the business section, business plan section, and now we're moving into chapter 4, How Entrepreneurs View Financial Statements. How entrepreneurs view financial statements. We're going to be starting with principle 22. You can't have too much cash when you start a business. This is going to be a very important chapter, everybody, because you're going to need to know about what you're looking at when you're viewing a financial statement. There's got to be a particular way that entrepreneurs view financial statements, or it wouldn't be a chapter in this book. Professor, you can't have too much cash when starting a business, can you?
No, you really can't. And the way you find out how much cash you have, you need, is to do a business plan. A business plan, it has two parts. The first part is a narrative, which essentially says what the business is and how it started and who's going to run it and the timelines and all of that. And the second part is a cash flow forecast. And it's from the cash flow forecast that you, the cash flow forecast, that you learn how much money you think you're going to need. And my suggestion is what you do when you come up with that is how long is it before you will turn a profit? And if you say, well, I'm going to turn a profit in 6 months, you either increase that by 50%, or you increase it by 100%, but you increase it a lot. So instead of being 6 months, it's going to be at least 9 months to a year. And then you say, okay, at 6 months, how much money is it going to take to get to 6 months? And you look at that, and then you say, well, that's fine, but what if it takes 9 months? And so you figure it's going to take you $100,000 to get to the 6 months. And so now you really think you're going to need, you better have 150.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way I've done that is I add 2% per month. And then when I get through, come up with that number, then with that number, I add 25% to that. And I've always been wrong on the short side.
Mm-hmm.
So
maybe you need to add 35%.
Yeah. So that comes up to like 35%, and then I find out I'm always short. So that's why I said instead of being short 35%, we'll figure it's going to take 150% of what you really figure instead of 135. And in some cases, that would have done okay. In other cases, it would be short again. So that's how you figure, how you come up with how much money you're going to need. And nobody ever went broke because they had too much cash. Doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. So you just, you got a plan, you know, you go back to everything costs more and takes longer. And once you've got that into your head, well, then you take your business plan and your cash flow forecast, and you say, okay, it's going to cost more and take longer, so we're going to add 50% to double it of what it says, and I better have that kind of cash, or at least that kind of cash available.
Well, what about somebody
that doesn't mean that you have to have $150,000 to do a $100,000 business. Now there's going to be, let's say you're going to start off, you're going to start a auto car repair, and one of the things you're going to need is a big commercial compressor. Well, you can go buy a big commercial compressor new. Maybe you ought to think about buying one used. If you think you absolutely have to have the new one, maybe you can lease it, lease purchase. In other words, hoard your cash. So if there's, when you first start, if there's a way to finance it, finance it. And because it may cost you 10% per year to finance it, well, if you find out that you really didn't need to finance it, you don't have to wait for the full year. If this thing went faster, you can pay it off earlier. So you want to make sure two things. One, that you could finance it, and two, that there isn't some kind of a great big early payoff penalty. Once you get those two things set, away you go.
Everybody, if you have a question, I see the lines are lit. If you have a question, all you have to do is just press 1. My special guest again is Professor Geiger. We're talking about how entrepreneurs view financial statements. Professor, Principle 23 is interesting as well. You can liquidate it, integrate it, or you can operate it. Okay? You can liquidate it, you can integrate it, or you can operate it. Professor?
Well, this has to do with buying a business, and I really should have put it under the next category down, buying a business, but we'll go over it here. And when you buy a business, everybody thinks immediately that I'm going to operate the business. But there are other choices. You can sell off the business. You can sell off the parts. And if you're buying a business that's in deep trouble, most turnaround operators who turn around companies that are financially challenged, usually they sell off a bunch of the parts. They sell off either the parts that are doing very well, and they sell those for a big profit, or they sell off the parts that are losing money, or they just liquidate the machinery, the assets of the business. So you can do that, and my suggestion is that you, when you buy a business, before you've actually cash into it, so when you have a little time to decide, you look at what would it be like to liquidate it, to cash it out. And there may be some ways that you can cash it out and come up with a big profit. Because the person who was there before didn't look at it that way. What that person looked at was running the business. That's what they were doing. And maybe you can liquidate it and sell off the parts of the business. The other part is that if you have a going concern now, you can integrate it. In other words, you can fold it into your current operations, and you just fold the parts in. Let's say it's a printing company, and you're already in the printing business. So instead of operating it as a standalone business, you operate it as part of what you have. And let's say that when you buy the business, it has an old Heidelberg press, and those aren't used very much anymore in the U.S., virtually none. However, they're used elsewhere. And I have a friend who had a business, and he had a Heidelberg press, and it was a colossal thing. And it was in his way, and he was going to just junk it. And this is right when the internet came out. So he was kind of techie, so he advertised it on the internet, thinking that he was in California, and thinking that, well, maybe somebody in Southern California would be interested, or maybe Northern California. Well, as it turns out, he got somebody from Chile who wanted to buy it, and they offered him like three times what he thought he could possibly get. And they did everything. All he did is he bought a new press. He took that one, he set it in the backyard, put a tarp over it, and behind the building, and they took it from there. And they paid him $25,000, and his new press cost like $23,000. So he traded something that he couldn't use. He liquidated something he couldn't use, and it paid for something he really wanted in full. So when you go to buy a business, you want to look at what are the possibilities of selling it off. I mean, maybe you could double your money, and you could double your money in 6 months. You could do that. You can fold it into your current business if you have one, and the last option is you can operate it. So you need to look at all three of those before you actually buy the business.
Well, you might want to talk for a moment then, Professor, even about when viewing, again, back to how entrepreneurs view financial statements. If you're going to buy a business, you better look at the books. You know,
oh, yeah.
You better view their financial statements before you buy it. Can you talk about the importance of that? I mean, just being before buying the business, you better know how they've done. You need to see some sort of record, some sort of statements, the books, the financial records that will verify that if, in fact, the seller making these outlandish claims that, oh, the business is, we did X amount and, you know, we did X amount of $1 million in sales last year. I mean, you need to, as one of your principles says, trust but verify.
Right. Well, you need to look at the finances, but you need to break them down into their various parts. So when I was in college, I learned how to do a financial statement. But it frankly, what we were taught is to look at kind of the bottom line and a few of the other things. But after I got into it and learned it, you know, got into the business world pretty well, I learned to go through their financial statement very carefully. So, for example, what are the accounts receivable? And let's say you have a business that did $1 million worth of business, and they have $200,000 worth of accounts receivable. You'd say, oh, my God. And so what can we do with this? Why do they have that much accounts receivable? Is it collectible? May not be collectible. It may be collectible, and they haven't done it. What do they have in assets there? Like my friend, do they have a Heidelberg press that's sitting off to the side and they're not using it? And they have it, they have depreciated it down to nothing, or they've depreciated it down. They probably wouldn't do nothing, but they might depreciate it down to $100 and keep it on the books for $100. Well, in that case, it was worth $25,000 to somebody in Chile. So when you look at that, you have to go through it step by step. And in my classes that I teach on entrepreneurship, one of the things we do is we take a very simple financial statement and we break it down and go through it area by area. So how much do they have in inventory? And so we go back to our $100,000, and let's say they have $300,000 in inventory and they're selling $1 million. That's 30%. That's insane. When you look at really well-run businesses that have much less than that. Now they have they have 30%, so that means that they have about 3 months worth of, well, better than three and a half months worth of inventory. A business like Walmart turns their inventory in way less than a month. I mean, they turn it like every 10 days. And in all their food stuff, they turn it in 3 or 4 days. Other things, they take longer, but the average is probably 15 days. And Kroger's turns theirs in even less time than that. But, of course, in the case of Kroger's, most of their stuff is perishables. So if you have, you know, a freezer full or a cooler full of milk, you better turn it virtually every day, maybe 2 days at the latest. And if you're not turning it that quick, you're in trouble. So you look at this financial statement, they sold $1 million worth of stuff, and they have $330,000 worth of inventory. So they have 33% in inventory. My goodness, they have way, way too much inventory. So if they had that and they had some other things, maybe you could sell off a bunch of the inventory. How do you do that? Do you sell? Do you have a crash sale for the inventory, or do you set reorder points and you for every item and you sell down to those reorder points? So if you had a, well, we'll make math really easy. If you had $1,200,000 at cost of inventory, that means you're selling $100,000 a month. And if you had $300,000, it takes you 3 months of inventory. It takes you 3 months to sell that off. That's insane. So maybe what you ought to do is go through your inventory, set reorder points, and sell off two-thirds of your inventory before you order a damn thing. So when you go through that financial statement, you don't just look at the overall financial statement. Did they actually sell $1,200,000 worth of stuff? I mean, that's all well and good, but the details are what really counts. And in the book, I do that. I take this little business and take a financial statement and break it down into its little parts, and we go through it part by part. And in this little business, we bought the business for about $80,000, as I recall. And in the first year, by being smart about it, we got our $80,000 back plus a $20,000 profit, and without selling any more than they did the previous year. But we did it by being smart about it. And when we got through, essentially at the end of the year, the people who sold it to us gave us the business. We got all of our money back. And we were operating the business, and we were making the same amount as they made. Actually, we were making more. And I go through it step by step, how you do that. in the book. So remember when we first started talking, I said the big difference between my book and others is it gives you principles that are actionable. So you go through this financial statement and you learn how to analyze the financial statement part by part and then what to do to take action to make a better running business.
Now, Professor, of course, there are people out there who are listening who may say, well, you know, all this stuff about financial statements and cash flow forecasts and all that, man, I'm not good at math, you know. Is it all right if I hire an accountant to do that, or do I need to be on top of that stuff? I mean, do I need know what the accountant knows me, because who's going to be watching the, who's watching the watcher, right? So if the accountant is watching the money and I'm not an expertise, and my expertise isn't numbers, how do I know if the accountant is doing what the accountant is supposed to do? I mean, because I don't want people out there to hear you talk about finances and get dissuaded, but this is information that you're going to have to know. You don't have to be a mathematician, you know, but you're definitely going to have to take this section very, very seriously. This is not a section you can overlook and,
that's,
you know,
true,
just say, well, hey, I'll, you know, I don't have to worry about that. No, you definitely need to know about that. But Professor, what would you say to somebody who, you know, says, wow, you know, I didn't, you know, I know how to fix cars. You know what I mean? I don't, you know, I'm not a wizard when it comes to the math. You know, what would you say to that person?
Well, I would say that when I was in college, some almost 60 years ago, I passed accounting one and got a C or a D in accounting two. I hated it, absolutely hated it. Nowadays, you don't have to be an accountant. You can do your daily books thanks to a computer program. And the computer program does it all, and all you have to do is enter the items coming in and the money going out, and you just enter that, and they teach you how to do that on the accounting. So it's frankly pretty easy to do. To talk about, do you need an accountant? The answer is absolutely yes, because you're going to have an accountant to do an audit once a year. But what I'm talking about here, you're not being an accountant. All you're saying, what you're doing is you're saying, for my business that I have a little grocery store. And this little grocery store that I bought had an inventory that was a third of their total sales. You don't have to be able to add two and two and get four to look and say, we sold $1.2 million and we at wholesale at cost, and we bought, we had in stock at any given time $300,000 worth of stuff. Well, we're not being, all we're saying is we can't do that. Other grocery stores are able, instead of having $300,000 worth of stuff, they may have $50,000 worth of stuff. So what I need to do is, how do I go from having $300,000 worth of stuff and sell it down to 50? Well, the way you do it is you take an inventory and you have 10 blue widgets, and you look at your, when did they sell those 10 blue widgets? Well, they've been selling two widgets a month. That doesn't sound like it's working out really well. Maybe what we ought to do is sell our 10 blue widgets down to when we have two. And when we have two, we place an order, and we order two more. So at the height, we have four widgets, and we sell those down to two with an eye to saying, maybe we ought to have max out at three widgets and sell them down to one. We always have a widget for sale, a blue widget for sale, but we have cut from 10 down to an average of two. So, and each of those widgets cost us $10. So instead of having $100 invested in blue widgets, we now have $20 invested in Blue Widgets. So that's you don't have to be an accountant to do that. If you're running a auto repair, how many spark plugs do you have in stock? Do you have 4 months worth of spark plugs in stock? Well, what do you have 4 months worth of spark plugs in stock for when you can get them in 24 hours? So maybe what you ought to have is 1 day's worth of spark plugs in stock. So when somebody comes in and you have to change spark plugs, you've got it there, but you go pick up the spark plugs, you order another set, and you put the ones you have in, and tomorrow the new set comes in at 8 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the only kind of math you have to be good at. And that doesn't take real math to be good at that. All it takes is to know I've got way too much inventory than what others have. So you got to find out what is normal in your industry and say, how can I be at least average and hopefully a good deal better than average?
Everybody, my special guest is Professor Joseph Geiger. We're going through the book, Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, 105 Business Principles, chapter by chapter, principle by principle. I think we're going to have to cut it there for now, and we're going to pick up next time, and this is a great one, too. We're going to pick up next time with you're broke if you can't make payroll on Friday. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
you are broke. If you can't make payday on Friday, you are broke. Don't matter if you get the money on Saturday, right, Professor? If you don't have it on Friday,
nope.
You're broke.
If you don't have it, if you're going to get it next Tuesday, that's fine. But all your employees just walked because you couldn't pay them on
make
Friday.
Make sure everybody. We're going to have Professor Geiger back every 2 weeks now. Professor comes on normally every other Tuesday. Just unfortunately, we had to. There was an issue yesterday, so we had him on today. But make sure you tune in every other Tuesday as we're going through the book one principle at a time. Professor, would you tell people how they can get the book? I know after
sure
listening
can.
To this show, but I don't know how to do
you
it.
You can get it at Amazon, Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, or you can get it at my website, which is theroadtothetop.com. TheRoadToTheTop.com, and it costs the same at both. It's $18, and so there you go.
And they can get a cash flow forecast by going to the same website. And
you can get a cash flow forecast at going to the same website. In that case, you pay $15, and I email it to you. It's an interactive one. It's 26 pages. It looks pretty daunting, but it's like everything else I do. It's fill in the blanks. And you don't have to be able to add two and two and get four. All you have to do is fill in the blanks. And it's very simple, but it's extremely thorough.
Everybody, by the way, Professor Geiger has written another book called Finding a Career for Life. Could you talk real briefly about that book, Professor?
Well, I wrote that because I had so many students who would come in and say, I had several who had master's degrees, and they you know, when I found that, I said, well, what the heck are you doing in here taking a course on entrepreneurship? And they said, well, I got this bachelor's degree, and when I went out to try to find a job, nobody would hire me. And then I did a little research and found out that there just aren't any jobs for this kind of a degree. And I said to myself, well, I could have told you that before you started the master's degree, much less finished it. Matter of fact, I could have told you that the day before you started college, that if you followed that path, you'd end up with a degree that does not have a job at the end of that rainbow. So what I did is do a lot of research, organized it in such a way that a person can look through the book and find out if what they think they want to get a life's work at, that's the way to go. And it does not, I don't make any effort to try to sell college or junior college, community college. I don't try to sell anything. All I do is report information and do it in a very organized and easy way. So if you decide you want to get a bachelor's degree and you want to get it in engineering or science or something like that, you can get a bachelor's degree in petroleum engineering. Costs you the exact same amount as any other bachelor's degree. The difference is that you can expect to make $180,000 a year with a petroleum engineering one. And if you got one in a couple of other engineering disciplines, you can expect to make $60,000 a year. So, and it's written in stone. I mean, this isn't hyperbole. This isn't guesswork. This is what actually is happening. So that's what the book does. And it doesn't, a bachelor's degree in petroleum engineering costs exactly the same as a bachelor's degree in psychology. In psychology, you'll be lucky to get a job that'll pay $40,000, or you can get a job that will pay $180,000. Costs the same. Same amount of time, same amount of cost. You just make eight times as much.
You know, I think, Professor, a lot of people are shocked by that statement that it costs the same. I think that people just assume that, somebody going to school for petroleum engineering would pay more for that degree than somebody going to school for art. You know,
no.
I think that people would just that.
Both of them would take 4 years. Your living expenses are the same. You eat the same. You go out the same. The tuition is the same. Everything's the same. Difference is in result.
Difference is somebody pays back their student loan a lot quicker than the other, huh?
Yeah, they pay it back in the first year. The other ones, they never pay back.
Make sure you get the book, everybody. My special guest is Professor Joseph T. Geiger. You can get that book at the same place, theroadtothetop.com. Okay, Finding a Career for Life. Make sure that you get the cash flow forecast. If you're serious about being an entrepreneur, you're going to need that for sure. And the book that we're talking about today, Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, 105 Business Principles. Professor, another fabulous show. We'll pick it up again in 2 weeks, sir. Awesome information. Thank you so much for being my guest. I really appreciate it.
Good enough. Call me back when we get through.
Yes, sir. Talk to you soon.
Talk
to you after
bye-bye.
The show.
Yep, bye-bye.
Everybody, my special guest, Joseph T. Geiger, author of the fabulous book, Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top. Wow, 105 Business Principles. This book just keeps on growing. Okay, it started off as 101 Business Principles, but again, it just keeps on growing. So, again, I'm very fortunate to have Professor on as my special guest, so I encourage you to keep tuning in. And if you haven't gotten this book, because you're not an entrepreneur, you may know somebody that's going to be an entrepreneur. Do you realize that the ranks of the entrepreneur are growing by leaps and bounds? And as Professor stated in one of our shows, that during the course of a working person's lifetime, that the odds of that individual becoming an entrepreneur during the course of their lifetime is growing by leaps and bounds. Okay, so you want to make sure that if you decide to go it alone, that you have everything that you need at your disposal, that you have a compass. And this book can help you navigate the waters. I've actually read this book like four times, and I'm going to read it again because it's a good read. I mean, it's very interesting. A lot of interesting scenarios Professor goes through. And as he states, you're going to need more than about five principles if you're serious. I mean, because there are a lot of things that can happen, a lot of unexpected things. So you want to be prepared. And one of the ways that you can prepare yourself is to get the book, okay? So, again, to everybody, I want to thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. By the way, just want to announce that got a show tomorrow with Dr. Ruby Lathan. We're going to be talking about the 28-day going vegan transition 3-day detox, okay? It's and 3-day detox. It's the 28-day going vegan transition and 3-day detox. There are a lot of people out there that have thought about going vegan but just didn't know how. just didn't know how to make the transition. It's like, golly, do I just stop eating everything? Do I stop eating everything that I love? No, you don't have to. There's a way to do it. And Dr. Lathan is going to be talking about it tomorrow, okay? So tune in tomorrow, 7 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time with me. My name is Juwanza and Dr. Ruby Lathan. But until then, everybody, go to the Road to the Top and order the book, okay? Entrepreneurial Success with Professor Joseph T. Geiger. You will certainly be glad that you did. My name is Juwanza, and I thank you so much for your time. I truly do appreciate it. I do understand that you could be doing something else, but you're here with my person, and so I certainly want to say thank you. So, again, my name is Juwanza. Who am I? I'm the one who, in giving, receives more. Who are you? Peace.